I enjoy talking about science and hearing about science and education. We spend a lot of time every day, as a matter of fact, talking about it as part of my job as a professor here. But it's always great to have Bassam Shakashiri come by to let us know what's going on in the world of science and education, science and mathematics and education, science research. Certainly, when he comes by, he enjoys hearing what you have for questions and comments as well. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Bassam, welcome back.
Happy to be here, Larry, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well.
Go ahead. You were asking for suggestions for people. I don't know if someone suggested Jeff Skiles. He's from our area. Jeff Skiles is the co-pilot of the U.S. Airways plane that went down a year ago in safely on the Hudson. I know Jeff because he was a student in my class.
Oh, great.
In fact, you have several guests who are students in my class. Yesterday you had Patricia McConnell.
Yes.
She was a student in my class. Phil Pelletieri, is he?
Yes.
He's a student in my class. Well, anyway, Jeff Skiles is my suggestion.
Well, you know, there's an interesting I got an interesting email the other day. Somebody has developed a it's essentially that plane and its flight, and then they've got the conversation that took place among the pilot, co-pilot, and so forth, and the ground crew, and then you're kind of in the plane and from the pilot's perspective.
It's a simulation.
So it's a simulation.
Yeah.
That's about runs about whatever it was, three minutes or whatever it was before they landed in the water, and it was really I sometimes don't click on all that stuff, but I clicked that one on, and it was really fascinating.
It is fascinating, and I've seen Jeff since that heroic landing. So anyway, that's my suggestion.
All right. Well, I tell you what, we've got lots that I think we can talk about. There was a new study by Lindsay and Salzman in the current issue of Science magazine. I don't know if you saw it or not, but they're talking about losing our competitiveness to inadequately trained science students, and also the lack of social and economic incentives to pursue careers in science and technology. How do we keep top students like Jeff, for example, in the field?
Well, that's a very interesting study. It was published recently, as you say, in Science magazine, and what it talks about is finding successful ways to retain talented people in the science and engineering pipeline and for doing research and teaching in science and engineering. And what they find is that there is a so-called leakage in this pipeline, because a lot of people who are trained as scientists and engineers, I don't want to say a lot, but several people who are trained as scientists and engineers, then pursue other endeavors. They go into Wall Street, for example. They have great mathematical skills. They have great reasoning skills. And they do other things. And I think that's a good thing. We need people in all walks of life who are knowledgeable about science and who can use science effectively in what they do. The concern that is expressed about having a good scientific workforce is the one that we need to address and try to prevent this or diminish this leakage by attracting more people to go into science and into engineering. And the careers are very attractive, and they are they pay well.
There are
hiccups in the job market, no question about it. I mean, last year and the year before, the job market was not so good for scientists and engineers. But regardless, I think what's important is to have proper training in science and in engineering, regardless of what profession one decides to pursue, because such training in science and mathematics and in technology will help us become better citizens and better members of society that can really help advance all aspects of society, not just the scientific and engineering aspects.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the National Science, just another topic to bring up here. And by the way, you can join in with your comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. NSF, or National Science Foundation, has released a report which says the federal government remains the largest source of academic research and development, but its share is dropping. How much the UW-Madison receives quite a bit of money for its academic research and development from the NSF, and I think ranks pretty high in the country.
My colleagues are very successful in pursuing support from the federal government as well as from other sources. In the last fiscal year 2009, UW-Madison received about $1.1 billion for awards and grants for sponsored research. Not all of it came from the federal government.
That's an amazing figure.
It is amazing. It is really a tribute to the quality of faculty and the quality of people that we have here, and also to the ambiance, the environment that we find ourselves in. And frankly, Larry, that's not an accident. UW-Madison is really a world-class university in terms of attracting faculty, students, researchers, and it is a very, very good place to be at. I can say this with some credibility. This is my 40th year here.
Yes.
I know the place very well, and I'm very, very proud to be a faculty member here. UW-Madison in 2008, in the fiscal year 2008, which is the year when the data are available, ranked number 3 in the country in securing federal funds. This is really, really, as I say, a very remarkable achievement, and we want to keep it that way. How do we keep it that way? By keeping the people here, by attracting young talent to come to Madison, by sharing the wisdom of people who have been here for a long time and have them really provide some guidance as to what this university is really about. This is the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It is really the flagship of our higher institutions in the state here. 60% of this research expenditure that we got, which is about half of the $1.1 billion that I mentioned to you, 60% of that goes to support the life sciences and the medical school. About 11% supports research in engineering, about 8% in the physical sciences, and about 5% in the social sciences. So that's a pretty good spread, but the lion's share goes to the life sciences, and rightly so. That's where the emphasis in.
Yeah.
That's where the emphasis is. But let me, as a physical scientist, quickly point out that all of these advances in all sciences are based on what has been done successfully in the physical sciences. So research in the basic areas is very, very important. And supporting research in basic areas is extremely important. And that's why we want to really continue this great trajectory that we're on to achieve even higher rankings, higher ranking in terms of our ability to secure funds for supporting research and educational activities in the sciences at UW-Madison. This is something that is really very, very critical. The exact number for fiscal 2009 from the federal government for UW-Madison is $587 million. Which is, again, a tribute to what goes on campus here. And it is really a telltale. It's an indicator of how good we are. But the better indicator is what we do with this money and how we use it successfully to educate undergraduates, to train graduate students, and to serve our state and the entire nation that really pays for this support that we get from the federal government.
I want to turn to some callers now. Again, you can join in with your questions as we talk science research, science education, science in general with Bassam Shakashiri. Bill in La Crosse, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Good to talk to you. My question is has to do with Einstein's science theory of relativity. And somewhere I've read, and I can't think, that there's been some second questions about whether that is true or not. Do you know anything about that? And have we more or less proven it or not?
In science, we always have questions. Progress in science is made by being skeptical, by asking questions, and by either affirming what we know or learning what reality is. I don't know specifically about the question that you're asking here, but let me just, as I said, repeat that progress in science is made by asking questions. And there are many, many experiments that are being done that have proven Einstein's theory of relativity. And so that's my response.
So, yeah, and that's I haven't heard that it was disproven, but it's something that we can look into. On the federal budget, just before we take our break here, someone was wondering how much of that budget of the research funding, federal funding, comes from Defense Department, the Defense Department. We have
For UW-Madison?
Yeah.
Not much at all. Some of it does, but it's all open. But it's all open. There are no restrictions on it. There are funds from the Department of Defense, from the Air Force, from the Navy, for doing all kinds of research in the physical sciences, in the biological sciences, in the medical sciences. I don't have the breakdown for that, but
it's not a huge amount, though. I don't
know. No, but okay. But there are people who are funded by all government agencies in an open, competitive process, which works, you know, on the basis of peer review. And it's very successful.
And we'll talk some more about that with Bassam Shakashiri right after a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we talk science, research, and science education, what's going on in the world of science. And certainly Bassam Shakashiri has some answers for you and some comments for you. I hope you'll join in. He's UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea, and it's always great to have him come by. He stops by once a month or so to talk with us. And Mark in Mequon has a question for you, Bassam, so we'll go to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to preface my comments by saying that I have a lot of respect for your guest. I think he's done wonderful things for making science accessible to the common people like myself and families, and has done tremendous things for the state and the university. However, I'm calling to take issue with a comment he had made on a previous appearance on your show.
Okay.
And what he had said was he was talking about grades. And he was talking about grades in his classroom specifically, and how he wished that parents were not pressuring students to get high grades, and they shouldn't be so hung up on that, so to speak. And my comment, first of all, is most of those students would not be sitting in his classroom at the University of Wisconsin if they didn't have parents pushing them to get high grades in their high school years, because the admissions policies for the University of Wisconsin are so strict, and the fact that if you do not finish your high school years in the top 10% of your class, you can, for the most part, forget attending University of Wisconsin as a freshman. And it is us, and so it's just a contradictory experience where parents need to push these kids and need to push them to higher grades in order to have opportunities to attend fine institutions like the University of Wisconsin. And so it's not us, so to speak, being difficult or pushing these kids. It's for their own good.
All right. Thank you for
Mark.
Calling.
Thank you, Mark. And can you stay on the line, Mark, for a second?
Yes.
I really appreciate what you said earlier, and appreciate more your question and your comment. And thank you for the follow-up for something I did mention earlier. I do believe parents want the best for their children. I do. And I do believe that getting a good academic record is something that is highly desirable. But it does not mean that everyone should expect to get an A in every course that they take. And I think that the pressure, what I called earlier, and I will call it again now, the undue pressure that some students, not only in my class, but elsewhere, experience when the report card comes in and shows that not every grade is an A, I think requires guidance, compassion, requires inspiration, requires parental care, more so than saying, well, you did not get an A in this course, and therefore you're no good at doing this and doing that. I quote these words verbatim, repeated to me from students who have come to see me after grades were announced. Grades are important, don't get me wrong, but they're not the most important thing. What I urge is that we all try to inspire students to learn and to learn at their own pace. The semester grades are given at the end of the semester for academic performance done that semester. Learning does not stop at the end of the semester. Learning continues based on skills that have been developed or were being developed when someone was in a course. So grades are not the final judgment of anyone. Grades are important. I do take issue with the grade requirements for admission. I mean, that's, you know, you're opening up a topic here that I care about. There has to be some standards for admission, but it's not only based on grades. So what do you say, Mark, to what I just said?
Well, my comment or response is that I couldn't agree with you more about grades. I feel exactly how you do. However, I believe these institutions, in University of Wisconsin being one of them, have developed a system or created an atmosphere that you, if you are not performing and your grades are not at that very high level, that you are not acceptable to them. I agree with you that learning goes on forever and that parents should back off and let the child develop at their own pace. But the admissions policies of these universities do not support that perspective.
Mark, let me share with you and everyone else who's listening something else. I know students, not only in my class, but in other classes, who were admitted to UW-Madison with a record, academic record. And I can tell you that their performance in my class clearly showed that they were not adequately prepared for doing college work. So what I'm saying is that the admission process is not perfect. And yet grades are one of the criteria for admission. You're right. If it weren't for the academic record of these students and the supporting documents that they provide when they apply, they would not be in my class. You're right about that. And my job in my class is to take what I have and try to do the best with them to overcome whatever deficiencies they may have, if they had any, and also to inspire the ones who really belong in the class and have them develop adequate, proper skills, learning skills to succeed not only in my chemistry class, because that's what I teach, but to succeed in life. So it's a fantastic opportunity for a faculty member to have students admitted to the university, regardless of whether the admission process is perfect, and try to do something positive, do something of high quality with those students. I can't tell you how many times I hear from former students who were C students in my class and what they're doing now. I'm getting goosebumps even just mentioning it now. This is not about me. This is about the educational system that we want to have in our university. This is about what the university aspires to do, what the university is for, is to inculcate the spirit of learning. And, of course, we have to make some judgments based on tests. So the grades are only based on tests, Mark, not based on anything else. And tests have their positive values, and they also can have a negative value if one does not act according to the advice that the student receives when they visit with me or with their instructor after the test.
And with that, I really appreciate your call, Mark. We're going to move on and take some other calls here. Thank you again for calling, and we'll move on to perhaps another topic here. Let's go to David in Minneapolis. David, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I got to say, I drive a route from Minneapolis to Eau Claire every day, and I love the variety of your afternoon programming here.
Thank you.
Last month in Wired magazine was a provocative article about the history and potential of thorium atomic reactors. Since you have a chemistry professor on the air, I thought he'd be an excellent person to help, raise public awareness. My dad was a physics teacher, and I had never heard of one until I read this article. So I know that it's not in the public mind, but in our carbon neutral obsessions and cheap energy goals and oil independence, I thought he might be able to shed some light for people.
All right.
I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, David. Thorium reactors.
Yes, David, there are many research projects that explore alternative sources of energy, and I have not seen this article in Wired magazine, so I cannot address it directly, but there are, even at University of Wisconsin-Madison here, there are research activities that deal with nuclear energy. Mm-hmm. And thorium is, of course, one of the radioactive elements. And so I cannot comment specifically about that article, David. I have not read it. I'm not familiar with the process that is mentioned there. But you know how it is, Larry. When I come on your show, I learn a lot of different things. So I'm going to go and read that article and see what I can learn from it.
All right. And maybe they'll wind up with a post on your website, too.
For sure.
All right. That's something that happens after every program that Bassam's here. After a bit of time back on his website, SciFun, SciFun.org, you'll find some comments relating to this show and a whole lot more, too. It's a really great site. So I thank you very much for calling. Dave in Madison, let's turn to you next. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon. Two questions. First off, on being in the science community. Now, has anything ever happened to those scientists that were found guilty of lying about global warming and those emails? Number one, has anything happened to those scientists? And two, can you give me an example of any example of scientists that did stuff like that, where basically they were more or less barred or knocked out or kicked out of the scientist community?
Yes, there are known documented cases where a scientist fabricated data and published it, and it didn't take very long before it was discovered that it was fraudulent. Fraud is not tolerated in scientific inquiry, the person lost their job. This has happened not only in the United States, but in Korea and in other countries, where people have published research in research results that were made up. This is an area that we have to always be vigilant about. We, I mean, and the scientific community, to make sure that Everything that is published is verified and is validated. And if not, you know, the people who claim to have done something and they didn't are punished. Now, you asked the question about the controversy regarding climate change. And that's, I think that's still being investigated. The person who did whatever he did with the email messages no longer has his job, but he may get it back. I don't know. That investigations are taking place there. Regardless, what that person did was wrong, but does not in any way discredit what the research clearly shows about climate change.
Thanks again, Dave. Mary in Green Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Yes. Hi. I just wanted to thank Dr. Shakashita for being on. We're a homeschool family. I had two boys that I homeschooled through high school. I was just kind of responding to your previous caller's comments about how tough it is to get into Madison. But one of the things I did is I found Dr. Shakashiri's curriculum on the Internet when they were in middle school, and his chemistry curriculum, and it just really intrigued me. I was a chemistry major in college, and I just thought it was a cool curriculum. So we used many of his projects and had just a blast doing it, and both my boys have been accepted to Madison. My first just finished up his first semester, and we did homeschooling. It wasn't easy, but a lot of parental input there, as you can imagine. But we just really have a kind of a warm feeling in our heart for Dr. Shakashiri, even though we never met him. And I've actually asked my son to try to get in his section this semester so he could get to meet him. So we saw your name on the board when we took the tour, and we saw that you had a great pedigree, that you were taught by a chemist who was taught by a chemist who was taught by a chemist who went way back to a famous chemist that's in the yearbook, and I told my son, this is the guy you want to learn from. So he's trying to get in your section. I think he just got bumped out, but he's trying to get back in. So kudos to you for your great Internet curriculum and your support through the years. Just a homeschool opinion here.
Thank you, Mary. I'm so glad that homeschoolers are benefiting from what we post on the web, and I assure you and everyone else that what we post is carefully designed and validated, and I'm really very grateful for your comments. In fact, you're embarrassing me by what you said.
He's blushing a little bit.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments as we talk science, research, and education with Bassam Shakashiri. Ricardo in Madison, we turn to you now. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi. I really want to applaud what Professor Shakashiri talked about, correcting some of the deficiencies in students who are coming into the university. But I wanted to ask him, what he thought of what I see as a kind of tendency to use a lot of courses, especially in the sciences, as weed-out courses. And it seems to me that there's a tendency that we have to select students for advancement rather than educate all of the students. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right.
Well, thank you, Ricardo, for your observation. It is true, but much less so now, that some of the basic introductory courses are used to weed, as you put it, students. I don't like that term. I take the students who are registered in my class as a captive audience, and I want to do my very best to have them learn chemistry, of course, and learn how to study chemistry and develop good studying skills. I think it's very important to have faculty teaching at the undergraduate level. It is critical to have the best faculty teach at the introductory level. And sometimes that's not possible because someone goes on a leave of absence and we, you know, hire a temporary lecturer and so on. But I think it's very, very important to use the courses that the students sign up for, especially in the first year, to help with the transition from high school to college. It's a difficult time for students. And it is really a responsibility of the professor to help with that transition in terms of developing academic skills and making sure the students realize that even though some of the words sound familiar, now the depth of discussion is different than it was in high school. And I tell you, Ricardo, I worked very hard on this with my graduate teaching assistants, with my staff, and I'm always trying to find ways to reach the students so that they can succeed in going through that transition. And what happened this past semester, after my first exam, I asked my students to write a reflection paper, to reflect, take time to reflect on what they did on the examination. In fact, what I did, I asked them to reflect on a weekly basis, kind of make an inventory of what they have learned and share this with me. And, you know, out of 350 students, I got about 250 responses. Mm-hmm. That tells you something about what I had to do to read them. But you're right. The purpose of the first-year course, the purpose of undergraduate education is to inspire, motivate, help shape the future of the individual more so, much more so than weeding. I don't really like that term at all.
And as a matter of fact, the university's charge on this or thinking on this anymore is once we used to talk about weed out courses, but once a student is here, our goal is to do everything we possibly can to get him or her a good education and through this program, not to have the person fail, but to have the person succeed.
Absolutely. And it, you know, undergraduate education to me is a transformation that individuals go through. Of course, they have to be willing to to put the effort into it and to realize that the effort that they put in has to be effective and efficient. And this is one of the things that we talk about, you know, how to budget your time, how to have a good time outside of class.
Yeah.
But the purpose of undergraduate education is to help the individual transform into a learner and not someone who just simply memorizes things and you know, puts them back on the examination. And another thing that we spend a lot of time on is trying to improve the quality of the examinations themselves.
Yeah.
And have follow-up to the exams that enable the students to catch up.
Someone else emailed and wonders, what makes a great teacher? Is it a matter of chance, or is there a science behind greatness?
Very good question. It's something I think about a lot. I haven't come up with an answer, but I do tell you that the environment that the person who is willing to be a good teacher, the environment is very important. It has to be a supportive environment. I've been fortunate to be a faculty member at UW-Madison here where the environment is highly supportive of innovation, highly supportive of all kinds of different things that one would want to try in their classroom. And I hope that continues to be the case. I see, you know, signs that it may not be, but I hope it will be that way. So I don't know. I mean, great teachers, someone said they're just born that way. But let me tell you something about teaching. Teaching is the most noble profession I know. And teaching is of course, related to the subject matter. So, you know, I'm a fairly good chemistry teacher. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'd be good at teaching piano, for example, although I have some suggestions and approaches that would coach someone as to what they would do. So I think great teachers are experts in their fields, and they find ways to share the excitement of what they do and the joy of doing science and how to deal with frustration when it is encountered, which is something that happens on a daily basis in all the research activities that we do. Great teaching is something that I support and I promote, and I'm always learning from other people how to be a better teacher.
Bassam, we have lots of callers online, but with that, we have to conclude. Thank you so much for being with us today. And I want to put in another plug for Bassam's website. It's been brought up a few times here on the show today. Take a look at it. It's scifun.org, scifun.org. There's lots of fascinating information. And I'm sure in a couple days there'll be more information about today's program. It usually takes, can't get it on there the minute the show's over, but usually within a couple days you're going to find some great information about what we talked about today on the program as well. You'll be back. We'll do it again. And just to mention, we'll talk about eagles tomorrow. It's Eagle Watching Days this coming weekend. And then we'll take a look at fishing lures. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.